My name is Janessa Duffy. I am currently the chief instructor pilot for Icon Aircraft in the United States. Most people know the Icon A5. It's a small two-seater amphibious airplane currently in the light sport category.
G'day and welcome everyone to episode number 5 of On The Step with That Mallard Guy. I'm your host, Dan Bolton. As always, folks, it is great to have you here with me talking all things float planes and flying boats. Now, I've been very busy this week tracking down some amazing people in the industry to get you the very best interviews all about seaplanes. And I'm very excited about what is coming to an earphone near you in the next few weeks. Now, as usual, it wouldn't be an intro to a podcast if I didn't ask you to give me some feedback. For example, oh, I don't know, how about you throw a 5-star review my way? That would be much appreciated. And as always, to get in touch, find me on Instagram at thatmallardguy or email thatmallardguy@hotmail.com. Now, today, I make the first journey outside of Australia to interview an American seaplane pilot. I'm guessing a few Americans will pop up in the future, that's for sure. Now, as you heard in the intro, Janessa Duffy is the chief instructor pilot at Icon Aircraft. She is instructing on one of the seaplane industry's hottest new toys on the market, the A5 Light Sport Amphibian. What a machine that is. Now, you may have already seen Janessa doing her thing on the Icon YouTube channel. Now, if you haven't, I suggest you check it out. They have some great videos of Janessa strutting the A5 stuff, along with some very cool instructional videos, including glassy water and rough water takeoffs and landings for the A5. So you can check her out on that, and also check her out on her Instagram page. It's at IGotYour6, and the number 6 there instead of the letters, IGotYour6. And Janessa, you certainly do got our 6 for coming on the show and giving us a very cool podcast. But first, folks, you ask the questions and I answer them. It's called Q&A. It's a very simple segment. We have a few more questions from the Instagram Q&A I posted last week. So let's dive straight into that. Okay, so this week's first Q&A comes from ESSJAYMCK, SJ Mick. Good lad, SJ Mick. His question is, how do you prepare to land if the surface is glassy? Great question, SJ Mook. Well, first of all, mate, the big threat obviously with glassy water landings are the fact that you cannot judge your height. The water reflects what is above it, so basically you're looking straight back up to the sky, and you can't judge how high you are above the water. There's a couple of things you can do to help with this. Now, the first thing is if you're landing in a river, well, you're going to be very close to the bank. If you're landing in open bays, you can try and land in areas that potentially have some objects in the water or it's closer to the shore that will help you be able to spot your height above the water a lot easier. So it's very rare that you'll get a full, complete glass out where you cannot see anything. You know, you generally need to go, you're doing a water landing generally to go to a dock or to a boat. So you can use those, if the shoreline or the boat, to be able to judge your height on the water. So that's the first thing that I would suggest. Try and tuck in a bit closer to some objects to give you a good height reference. Now, the second thing is a pretty obvious one. You want to set up a long approach. And the reason for that is you want to set up for the glassy water approach, which is generally 150 feet per minute rate of descent, probably from at least 100 to 200 feet above the water. It's pretty hard if you're in, say, a lake that's elevated, getting the exact lake elevation, but open ocean's quite easy. It's generally 0 feet. So starting that from about 200 feet and then just holding that 150 foot rate of descent all the way until the airplane just basically touches the water. So you're not flaring, you're basically just holding that attitude all the way until you feel the touchdown. Now, we're pretty lucky that in the Mallard we do have a radalt. So as a multi-crew operation, once we set up this approach, the pilot monitoring will read out the radalt altitudes from 50 feet. So just like you hear in the big airplanes there, 50, 40, 30. We basically do that for each other to help knowing where the water surface is. So that's basically how we would prepare to land if the surface is glassy. Thank you, SJ Mick. Now, the next question is from Julian the Rialt 13. How many bloody Julian the Rialts are there? Surely there's not another 12 Julian the Rialts around. Anyway, his question is, what are the requirements for working with you guys? Good question, Julian. So we generally don't take on anyone with bare float experience. So generally, you're going to have to come to our company to fly the Mallard with some sort of seaplane experience behind you. So as a rule of thumb, we look for people with about 1,500 hours total time, 500 water landings or around 500 hours of float time, and a multi-engine command instrument rating, because obviously we're IFR as well. Also, ATP subjects for progression onto a command rating. The ATP is required. So they're basically our requirements. Like I said, we don't employ anyone with bare float experience because the Mallard is just not the right aeroplane to learn how to fly on the water. So thank you, Julian the Rialt number 13. Now, finally, this is from Benjamin.Henning. His question is, what sort of jobs are you doing with the Mallard? Good question, Benjamin. Get asked this a lot. So the Mallard's primary role is to support our pearling company, Paspaley Pearls. They are the best pearls in the world. There is no doubting about that. So we fly the workers who go out there to clean the pearl shells where they grow, who live out on the ocean, basically, on big vessels. You've probably seen that in my Instagram stories quite regularly. So we go out there and we take basically those passengers out to their work for 2 weeks. It's like a fly-in, fly-out role. And we also take out food, fresh food for them as well. So that's basically our main work. We're stepping into commercial work now, and that includes fishing charters out to fishing vessels. It also includes camp charters, so coastal camp charters that are very hard to access in the middle of nowhere. And we're looking into our own safari product as well, where for 5 nights you can fly the Mallard all the way around the beautiful Kimberley and end up in another location, Broome, or start in Broome and come back to Darwin, and staying at some of the most pristine resorts through the Kimberley there, all via Mallard. Basically, you take off from the runway, and for the next 4 days you're spending on the water in the Mallard. And it's a really popular one. Unfortunately, with the COVID, we've had to cancel a few of those this year, but we're going to get them back up and firing very quickly next year. So that's basically all of our work. Thank you, Benjamin Henning, for your question. Okay, folks, it's now time for the main event. Let's remove our pedo covers, pull out the control lock, and get going on the step.
Right engine is turning. 12% fuel. A light.
Okay, welcome Janessa Duffy, all the way from Tampa, Florida. How are you going?
Up good. How are you doing?
Very, very good. I'm excited to have you on the show. You're the first international pilot I have on the step. Are you excited?
I'm very excited. I'm glad to be number one.
And first female seaplane pilot. That's cool as well.
Yeah, there are. I feel like there aren't that many out there. So it's always cool to see and hear other ones out in the industry.
We have there's a couple of girl pilots flying up in Broome in WA, flying caravans. They're both doing an amazing nice. Job. One's only like 22 and on a caravan. It's an amazing effort.
Wow.
Yeah, just for any pilot. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And and then one of them is actually the chief pilot. So killing it over in Australia as well, the female seaplane pilots. So good. Go girls.
Yeah.
Janessa, yeah, like I said, great to have you on the show and great to talk all about the Icon A5. I've been watching all the YouTube videos, all the Instagram videos. They really make this aeroplane look like the you know, the best toy you can have. And everyone's kind of dream seaplane toy. It's I'm really excited to get in there and talk all the nitty-gritties about the Icon and how you progressed into that role. But let's jump back a little step here and talk to us a little bit about what got you into aviation. And was seaplane flying always something that was on the radar straight away?
Definitely not straight away. I'll be honest, when I started flying, I knew zero about the industry whatsoever. I didn't have any friends or family that flew. I was in the Navy for a little bit, and when I got out, I honestly was just like super bored with my life. And I was going to school for IT at the time, and I was like, "This can't, this can't be it. I think I need something a little bit more exciting in my life." And I just randomly went out on a Discovery flight at my local airport. I just thought it was. I was like, "Okay, I can see myself doing this. I think I'll do this now." So when I first started researching being a pilot, I think the first thing that everyone sees is like, be an airline pilot. That's what you do. You yeah. go through your ratings, you become a flight instructor, and then you become an airline pilot. So I thought that's what I was going to do. And then once I got into it, I just realized that there's a lot of other things that you could do as a pilot in the industry other than being an airline pilot. So I've just been kind of exploring all the different avenues if I decide to go that route.
Yeah, exactly. It's almost like when you go to learn to fly, you need like several brochures, don't you, on like all the different things you can do in aviation, because there are so many and you don't know about any of them until mm-hmm. you actually get out and get your commercial license and almost fall into a different path.
Yeah, it's almost by accident. I feel like a lot of people end up in other roles other than being an airline pilot.
Yeah, I remember in my training, I was kind of just getting my license. I think I was the same. I was looking down the same route, although I had my old man who had a seaplane company in my hometown of Geelong. And that kind of got me sparked in aviation. But as soon as I started flying floats myself, I found that the love and the passion for seaplane flying just really took off. And now I'm kind of stuck in this avenue now, which is it's very rewarding anyway.
Yeah, definitely.
So what about the Navy stuff? So obviously that's around the ocean. So you've got a love for maybe the water. Mm-hmm. What kind of stuff did you do in the Navy?
Yeah, I was actually, I lived in Guam for 3 years. So mm-hmm. I was a communications electrician, and I worked on all the submarines that pulled into port, into Guam, and they flew us kind of all over, wherever they flew, wherever they pulled into port, we'd go fly around the world and fix them. So it was very unique, not a very small female oriented career there too. I think I was the only female in my shop of like 20 guys for a long time. But yeah, so I love the water. Also love the mountains, but definitely I think living on an island for 3 years and then being born and raised, Miami and Tampa, always, always love being around water.
Miami and Tampa, that looks like one of the pristine spots to be on the water in the States, I imagine.
Definitely, yeah.
Yeah, I'll have to visit there one day for sure. So is Guam, I don't really know too much about Guam. Is that, it's a tiny little island the States own or something, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a territory, which honestly, before I lived in Guam, I didn't know anything about Guam. They're like, "You're going to Guam." I'm like, "Where?
Yeah, where am I going? Where's that in the States?
Where is that?"
it's in Florida, yeah?
I absolutely loved it. It's very small. It's like maybe 30 miles long. It takes from the States, it's almost like a 20-hour flight to get over there. And then I didn't come back to the States for 3 years. So, I went to every place I went to was another island. I went to Saipan and Singapore and Hong Kong and Bahrain, but I never made it back to the mainland for about 3 years.
Did you, because there's a lot of, I think there's the B-52s based out of Guam for the American Air Force, is there? Do you see a lot of them flying around?
Yeah, the Air Force base is on the opposite side of the island, but it's interesting to, like, when you're not in aviation and how, like, little you pay attention to airplanes or anything related to aviation when you're not into it. I wish I would have probably, done like a Discovery flight in Guam or anything like that. They had, like, day trips to the little islands around there. I wish I would have been in aviation back then because it's probably some really pretty flying around there. But no, I never really paid attention.
No. We up in Darwin here, we're a military kind of town as well. We're right up the top of Australia, and we get a lot of the US Air Force crew come over regularly. They've got big military training days up here and weeks, really. And the B-52s come into Darwin quite regularly as well, so it's really cool to see those aircraft flying around and leaving their smoke trails all around the skies of Darwin. It's very impressive.
Yeah, I'm guessing if they're flying into Australia, they probably are coming from Guam. There's not that many other bases around that area that I know of, at least.
So you've been in the Navy for a few years. You're kind of getting bored in IT training. What made you take the step into becoming a pilot?
Just super random. I think I had another someone that was also in the Navy with me out in Guam. He had, I think he had just started flight training, and I saw some of his posts online, and I was like, hey, like what you're becoming a pilot? Like what, how's that happen? What's going on? And I kind of picked his brain a little bit. And then I was like, okay, well, I guess, I mean, I was like completely oblivious to general aviation. Like I didn't even know there were like local small airports surrounding me where I was living. So I started just doing some research. And after the flight, I was like, okay, this is really cool. I think I want to do this. And I like within 2 months, honestly, I had quit my job. I had just finished like my IT certificate that I was going to school for. So I had just finished. I quit my job. I packed up all my things. At the time, I was living in Clearwater, Florida, and I moved back down to Miami. And, within a couple of months, I was starting flight school.
I have heard a lot of people just kind of getting into aviation who have absolutely no idea, don't even realize, like you said, there's small airports around their hometown. It's crazy. And then they can make a full career out of it. Like aviation is obviously something you can do quite easily where you just don't have any idea, but you can just go down and find out and be hooked straight away. So that's really cool. So did you get straight into seaplanes out of your commercial license?
No, it was actually, I was like halfway through my commercial license when the 1500 hour rule kind of took into place. And at the time I had no intentions of becoming a flight instructor. Like that wasn't really a desire of mine to teach. But the 1500 hour rule kicked in and I was like, well, I have, 250 hours. How am I going to get to 1500 hours to get to the airlines like I'm supposed to? So obviously I became a flight instructor first and I started flight instructing, which I enjoyed. I enjoyed it way more than I thought I was going to. But still didn't think that it was going to be like a long-term path for me. And then I ended up, when I first started just getting into airplanes and aviation, I also, because I was used to kind of, working with my hands and everything from the Navy, I thought about getting my AMP license. So I had thought about in the beginning of getting my AMP license first and then becoming a pilot. But, for whatever reason, I decided to, start flying first. So after I got my CFI, I actually started working for an aircraft maintenance shop in Winter Haven, Florida. I moved back up towards Central Florida after I finished my certificates. So I started off doing like parts and inventory and just like helping on like avionics type installations and stuff, since I had a little bit of experience with that. And then I was they had a 172 for the aircraft maintenance shop. So we do some currency flights and flight reviews, and then owners that would bring in their aircraft, I would, do flight reviews with them or just go fly with them in their aircraft. And that's kind of how I started to build hours. But Winter Haven is the home of Jack Brown's, if you're unfamiliar. So
yeah, I was just looking that up on the net there. Yeah.
Yeah. So everybody knows Jack Brown's in the United States. That's where everybody goes to get their seaplane rating. And I think I was working at the aircraft maintenance shop for like a year. And at that point in time, I kind of started to look in different avenues besides just being an airline pilot. And, I have a little bit of an adventure streak in me. So I was like, seaplane flying sounds like it would be really fun. And I know there's not a lot of seaplane jobs out there besides being a seaplane CFI. At the time, there wasn't, at least. I was like, I'll just go get it. It's not that expensive. And, if I happen to stumble upon a job that requires a seaplane rating, then that's really cool. So I just walked across the airport and I got my seaplane rating. I think they offer it's like 2 days, 2.5 days and $1,500 or something like that. So it was pretty inexpensive. I did it over a weekend. I was really glad I did.
Yeah, Jack Brown's base looks pretty epic down there on the Cubs. Pretty iconic seaplane training provider down there in that area. And I was just looking it up on the map there. It's unbelievable how many lakes there are around that joint.
Yeah. They call it the Chain of Lakes City.
What a perfect spot for a seaplane operator.
Yeah, it's perfect. You just like literally you take off, you stay at like 200-300 feet, and then you land in another lake and you take back off and you land in another lake and you just hop around there all day long. That's pretty cool.
And are you able to just land in any of those lakes, or are there certain lakes that are only used for flight training and the flying out of Jack Brown's?
No, it's completely open. I mean, besides Jack Brown's, there really isn't a lot of other like personal owned seaplanes, which I've kind of started to realize that as a whole, there's not a lot of people that own seaplanes. There's a couple of flight schools around. there was another one just a little bit further south, but it was seasonal 6 months. And then the other 6 months they were up north. And then one or two other seaplane operate or like seaplane owners, but not a lot of seaplane, personal seaplanes that I've seen. It's very staggered here and there. So they were primarily the only ones out there flying, but once in a while you would see some other people. But for the most part, it's open. Florida is a really seaplane friendly state, so you can pretty much go anywhere you want.
Yeah, perfect spot to sell two-seat flying boat amphibians, really, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
So how long did you do the instructing job on the floats there?
You know, I didn't. I got my seaplane rating, and then I was still working at the aircraft maintenance shop. And through the aircraft maintenance shop, there was a gentleman that came in who operated seasonally, not at Jack Brown's, but a different operator. He had 185 on floats, and I think he had one Cub and like a 172. And so I started to get checked out in the 185 on floats to be able to start instructing. And I would probably say like in that process of doing that, Icon reached out to me out of nowhere. I didn't apply or anything, and asked me to come in for an interview. So I went to start to get checked out in the floats to start instructing. And then Icon picked me up pretty much right away. And I've been working for them ever since.
I think I saw on a video online that, yeah, you got picked up because of an interview you did on Flying Magazine, was that right?
Yeah, that's exactly how that they found me. They call it Live to Fly series, and they essentially just followed me around all day. And because I was doing all these different things, I was like apprenticing as an AMP. I was also flight instructing in 172s, and then at the time I was getting checked out in the 185. On floats just a little bit further south. So they published it, and the chief pilot at the time at the Tampa Flight Center for Icon, which had just opened up, saw my video online, and he reached out to me and got my contact information and asked me to come in for an interview.
I don't know if is the pilot shortage of seaplane pilots around that area, like, is that really bad? Or is like, what was the reason for reaching out? Was it because of your maintenance history as well, do you think? Or...
I think maybe like a combination of different things. At the time, I was one of the first. So Icon, the founder of Icon was retired or used to be an F-16 pilot for the Air National Guard. And a lot of the pilots that instruct for Icon are all ex-military pilots. None of them had seaplane ratings besides the founder, who, you know, he was an adventure guy who owned multiple different float planes and whole planes before he started the company. But none of them had any seaplane experience, and none of them really had any general aviation experience. So I guess when he saw that I was somewhat local, had seaplane experience, I was a veteran, and I've also been doing general aviation instruction, I guess he thought I would be a good fit, although they hadn't really hired any full-time civilian pilots before. And I just happened to be one of the first ones that they ended up hiring.
That's cool. Shows that social media, YouTube pays off, hey?
It does. You know, it's and I feel like it's gotten bigger now, like as far as everybody, like aviation influencers and people meeting online. But even 3-4 years ago, I feel like it wasn't really that big. So I was kind of surprised when they reached out. I was like, oh, and I saw their job postings before, but in their job postings, even it was like, you know, ex-military pilot preferred, you know, low altitude training, this, that, the other thing. I'm like, oh, well, this would be like a perfect job for me, but you know, I wasn't a military pilot, so I'm not going to even apply for it. And it ended up just working out.
So how much did you know about Icon before you actually got the job, other than that posting?
Yeah, not much. I saw the job posting, and then I started researching the company, and I saw the airplane, and I thought the airplane was super cool. I thought the technology that they were putting into it as far as the spin resistance and them flying by their angle of attack gauge. I thought everything was really cool about it. And the fact that a majority of the company were all veterans, I thought that was, interesting aspect, because you get a group of veterans together and it's just like, I don't know, it's like being in a brotherhood, and you joke around and it's just really easy to get along with everybody. So that is what attracted me to the company itself. And then the fact that it was seaplane flying was a huge perk.
Yeah, it's the military presence in America is crazy. You guys are so proud of your country and being in the military as well. It's it's not like we're not proud of our country over here, but it's just such a bigger presence in America. You know, like I remember I did my honeymoon over in California, and just the amount of American flags you see everywhere on houses, and it's crazy. You guys are so proud to be American. It's cool.
Yeah, we're all a little intense sometimes.
So let's talk about Icon, how this amazing little aeroplane that's capturing everyone's, gaze around the world, especially with their beautiful promotional videos. They're amazing. They're really, really selling this aircraft perfectly. So how long have you been at Icon? And talk to us a little bit about your job and what do you do in that role?
So I have been working for the company for almost 3 years now. I started off just as an instructor pilot. So we were in the beginning, we weren't really in, this is really our second year in production. So the first year that I was with the company, we had about 20 or so aircraft that were already built. We weren't in full blown production yet. So we were offering training to the public. Anybody that wanted to get trained in the Icon, come experience the Icon, they could come to either our headquarters, which was in Vacaville, or they come to our Tampa Flight Center. So in the beginning was a lot of training. I mean, we had students, multiple students in every week. We did some sales demos. We weren't really on the road or anything, just training. And then probably about 6 or 7 months after I was working for the company, we started actually producing aircraft and delivering aircraft to customers, which was, really exciting to see owners actually take airplanes home, because once in a while we would spot an airplane out and it wasn't one of our own. So it was kind of cool to see. But and then we kind of start to shift. So we stopped offering training to the public and we would only train our owners, because we did have so many deposit holders and people were starting to get in line to take their aircraft home that we couldn't really we didn't have the throughput to train anybody that wanted to get checked out and also train our owners that were about to take delivery. So we stopped training to the public. And I would say about after 8 months of being the instructor pilot for the company, I got promoted to the chief instructor pilot for the East Coast. And then from there, we kind of started to shift. We did this huge, we called it our angle of attack tour. We started off in Tampa and we flew all the way up. We had anywhere between 2 and 4 aircraft up in the air. And we flew from Tampa all the way up to Chicago, all the way over to Martha's Vineyard, New York area, and then back all the way down to Florida. And we probably, I think we did something insane, like a couple hundred demos. We stopped in every other state. We were on the road for 3 months doing this in rotations with everybody, which was crazy. We got to experience the airplane, really learn everything. Definitely experience different types of flying, especially if, Florida is extremely flat. We primarily fly in salt water around here. So flying to different areas and doing more mountain flying and lakes and got a lot of experience, which was really nice. And you got to really know the aircraft, which was good.
Yeah, that sounds like a fun trip. Are you going up all the way out the east coast of the States?
Yeah, it was crazy. I mean, we had crews, we had maintenance with us, we had sales representatives with us, and then we had instructor pilots. And every other place that we stopped, we would throw a social. So we'd have owners and deposit holders or people that were interested. We'd have a huge social. The next day, we would have full days of demos. And then we'd pack up and we'd fly in trailer, because obviously the plane folds. So we typically have like 1 or 2 planes on a trailer, and then 1 or 2 planes flying, and then we'd go to the next location and do the same thing all over again.
All right, so you actually drove the coast and then just packed up the plane onto the trailer and drove to the next spot, did your little demo, and off you went.
Yeah, it was nice, especially since like the A5, it's a light sport, right? So it's VFR flying only. So there were times when we were getting in areas where IFR socked in, we couldn't, but we had a deadline to get to the next location. We'd have to take, we'd drive multiple times back and forth, but we'd just stay, the pilots would stay, maintenance crew would trailer one plane, drop one plane off, come back and pick up the other. And then we'd all meet at the next location. So definitely benefited. You know, if you're going to fly VFR in a VFR airplane, the fact that you can trailer this and, you know, put it behind your car is a huge plus, you know, when you do hit that weather wall.
Yeah, it's such a unique aspect of aviation, really. It's just throwing your airplane on the trailer, going for a road trip, really, and and you know, being able to do some seaplane flying along the way. It's pretty unique. We don't see that a lot in aviation.
Mm-mm. And you'd be shocked. Well, probably not shocked. The expressions and people that gather on the airplane when they realize that there's an airplane being towed behind a car. It's pretty amusing to see people's facial expressions as you drive by them.
Yeah, exactly. And then you go take it down to the boat ramp and just back your plane into the water. That's better than a fishing vessel, surely.
Yeah. It was definitely a cool experience. So I was chief instructor pilot for the East Coast for probably about a year and a half. And then we kind of started to consolidate a little bit. And I eventually became what my title is now, which is manager of flight operations and training. So I'm in charge of the East Coast and West Coast instructors, demo pilots. I help with the training curriculums. And we also are building out we call them ICON authorized flight instructors. So we've been working on building out our network of instructors around the world. So it's been busy, but fun and rewarding and learning a lot. That's what I do now.
Yeah, sounds like you're killing it. So you talked about East and West Coast. What's the difference between the two and where's the other base on the West Coast?
The West Coast base is in Vacaville, which is just a little north of Napa. And that's where our final assembly plan is. So initially everything was run out in Vacaville. And that's just where our production facility, that's where everything was. And Tampa was just kind of an offshoot, like a flight center. That's really all it was. But just the people in Tampa have, we're all workaholics, I guess. But we've just slowly been taking over some of the aspects that were usually just controlled out on the West Coast are now kind of being controlled from the East Coast. So no difference. We have multiple sales reps on the West Coast and East Coast representatives. They just used to be, we had an East Coast chief instructor pilot and a West Coast chief instructor pilot, and then we would meet, but we controlled and kind of operate it separately. So now everything is just under one grouping.
Yeah, right. How many pilots does the whole company have?
So each one of our sales reps and, public knowledge, last year we did have quite a large layoff. I think we laid off, I think it was like 40% of our employees, of everybody. So flight operations didn't get hit that much. It was more production. But we, last year we had, we had closer to like 12 to 15 sales reps, which all of them are commercial pilots. Some of them were private pilot sales reps. Most of them were commercial, some CFI. So whenever they're in the cockpit, they kind of follow under me, under flight operations. And then instructor pilots, we have me, we had two other full-time instructor pilots here and maybe three part-time instructor pilots on the East Coast. And then West Coast, we have a full-time instructor pilot there. And then we have obviously our engineering pilots that help out with production and everything. And then we have maybe four or five contract pilots on the West Coast that help with training and sales demos, marketing events and stuff. And we have a few that are scattered, old full-time pilots that are now in different locations doing probably more so the airline work or corporate pilot stuff, but they still want to work for ICON. We still use them as contract pilots.
Yeah, cool. And what's the lifestyle like for the sales rep? Is that kind of what you did up the East Coast there on a bit of a road trip? Is that what they do? Or do they just deal with people looking at buying aircraft?
They definitely do. They get qualified eventually to do their own demo. So they all get their own airplane. They get a Tahoe and a trailer. So if they do have events, because we do a lot of events with like luxury car, like Lamborghini and exotic car shows and stuff like that. So and boat shows, yacht shows. So there are a lot of times when our sales reps are trailering the airplane to a location you can't fly into. And then they set up this like static display and they hang out for the day and they build their lead generation to eventually do demos. So yeah, I'd say they do fly. And then if they do full demo days is what we call them. So if it's one or two demos, they do it by themselves. It's not a big deal. If they want to do a social event or a full demo day, then we typically send out an instructor pilot from our flight operations team. So they can focus on the sales aspect and we can focus on the flight operations side of things.
Yeah, very cool. I'd like to know a little bit more about this angle of attack gauge. Can you give us a little bit of a rundown of how this works?
Sure. So we have two static boards on our leading edge, one above and one below. And it's essentially measuring the differential pressure from the wing, and then it sends it to electronic control unit that then displays it on our AOA gauge. And it's pretty simplified. It's, you know, we have essentially, it looks like a side profile of a wing that moves up and down. So typically cruising, it's going to be anywhere inside that green arc that you see on it. Typically it's going to be lower on the bottom side of the green arc. We have a white line that goes across it, which we essentially use for a couple different things. It's our best way to climb. So it's our VY. It's our best descent, and it's also our best glide. So in case of emergency, if you need your best glide, that's where you're going to put it. Our yellow line on our AOA gauge is our flare attitude for normal water and a normal runway landing, which is nice because you don't really have to, there's not a different attitude for landing on the runway versus landing on the water unless you get into rough water conditions or anything like that. So it's the same sight picture, which is nice. Mid-yellow, you'll get your stall warning horn, which is about 3 to 5 knots above stall. And then full red will be your full stall.
Yeah, right. Did it take a while to learn flying the Icon with that gauge?
No, I would say it's really intuitive, honestly. Within two flights, and it's because it is so prominent and it's right up front, your eyes just go to it. And then once you actually trust it and you believe what it's telling you, I think I look at my airspeed indicator on rotation from the runway, and then I honestly never look at my airspeed indicator again. Like, everything that we do is based off our AOA gauge. So I think it's really easy to learn, and I think it's a much better way to, and I get interpret on what's happening with your aircraft.
Yeah, right. It sounds very interesting. I'd love to have a go one day. So Janessa, give us the sales pitch for the Icon aircraft. Why should I, or why should the person who drives a Lamborghini buy an Icon A5?
So I am not a sales rep, so I will do my best. but people ask, like, oh, compare the Icon to this aircraft or compare it to this. Everyone has their own, you know, unique way of viewing things, or have their own things that they want in a specific aircraft. Obviously, one, the A5 is very unique looking. As far as aesthetically, I think it's one of the nicest planes to look at as far as two-seat amphibious airplanes. So I personally like the way that it looks.
I'll agree with that.
Yeah. And the second big thing, which when I think about flying any other airplane, is that, I mean, the A5 is the first certified spin-resistant aircraft that was granted that by the FAA with no waivers. Like, it's spin-resistant. So I think when people who may not realize that the amount of engineering work that went into that airplane to make it as safe as is, some people don't realize it. And I think it's incredible. I mean, this airplane handles incredibly well. Spin resistant, stalls are really benign. And I've flown some other light sports, not amphibious light sports, but, you know, and sometimes their stalling characteristics can be kind of erratic, and they'll stall differently, you know, based on, you know, you fly this one airplane and it flies this way, and then you get in the same exact model airplane, but you go to a stall, you're doing training, and it stalls a different way. And I don't know, I've flown probably 30 or 40 different individual A5s, and to me, they all fly the same. They all stall the same. And it's, I don't know, it's easy and it's fun. And I think if you're looking for seaplane flying and you're not looking to, you know, take 500 pounds of luggage with you, I think this is just a fun, easy plane to learn how to fly in, and also just go have fun, even if you're a really experienced pilot.
I guess, like, with the trailer aspect, it's almost like a pilot's dream jet ski, isn't it, really?
I mean, and some of our owners, they do. They have, like, this, they have a trailer. They either do, like, an enclosed trailer or just a regular trailer that we have, and they put it, like, on the back of their RV. And they'll just, it's like, and that's kind of the aspect that I tell people. I'm like, if you're thinking about doing like a road trip, if you're like one of those people that like road trips like motorcycle road trips or RV road trips. Like, this is not going to get you from A to B as quick as you possibly can. But if you want to have fun and make like an adventure, like travel journey cross country, then this is the plane for you, because you can go into so many different locations. And that's what's fun to me about this airplane.
Yeah, I just remember when I worked up in the Whitsundays. I don't know if you know about that area in Australia. It's a beautiful location on the Great Barrier Reef with 74 islands. And I remember when I was working up there, this RV came through, and he had this little 2-seat helicopter on the back. He was just trucking that around Australia. That, I thought that was pretty cool. But I think to have an amphibian, especially in the Whitsundays, would be amazing, really.
Yeah. Helicopter flying, definitely. I mean, we have a lot of helicopter pilots that come in, and they joke with us a lot. They're like, you guys are helicopter pilots, and you guys just don't realize it yet, because it's essentially the type of flying that you guys are doing, which is true, because, I mean, and I had thought about getting my helicopter license for a long time, and then it wasn't until about a year and a half of flying that the A5, I was like, I'm going to go do it, and I ended up getting I have my private helicopter add-on right now.
Oh, wow.
I'd like to go back. I'm trying to maybe at the end of this year or next year, go back and get my commercial add-on. So definitely very similar flying.
Yeah, I 100% agree. When I met my now wife, Jenna, in the Whitsundays, she was flying helicopters commercially as well. And
that's awesome.
She ended up getting her instructor rating, and we did a lot of flying together, where I was jumping in the right seat, which is the pilot seat.
It's different.
And
yeah.
And flying around the Whitsundays, landing on beaches and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. When she had a ferry machines back and forth to locations, it was helicopter flying is so cool. I love it. It's very addictive. But I think, like you said, I think any seaplane pilot would actually love helicopter flying, because they are so similar in a lot of ways, with being able to access locations that you just can't get to in a normal fixed gear airplane.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I tell you, your wife is brave, because I have a huge respect for helicopter CFIs, I tell you that.
Yeah, she...
It's way different than being a fixed wing CFI.
Yeah, exactly. She has some incredible training stories, that's for sure. Especially with me. In Australia here, we have our own little Seaplane Pilots Association of Australia group. It's not as big as America. Granted, there's really not that many seaplane companies in Australia, and there's not a lot of private owners of seaplanes in Australia, but there is a few. And I think I speak for a lot of them. We want to know, you're probably not the right person to ask, but we want to know, when is Icon going to be coming to Australia, and will there be any sales rep or services for Australia coming soon?
I would say very soon. I know that there are people inside Australia right now that are talking with our sales rep in California that are looking to export a plane there. So I would probably say within a year, you will definitely have an A5 somewhere in the skies of Australia. Obviously, we're a light sport category, so I think exporting it, importing it to Australia is a little bit complicated and definitely outside of my realm of knowledge, but I've definitely been learning. I mean, even we just sent an A5 over to, I think, Abu Dhabi, which was one of our first international sales. So we're working on the international sales market for sure. And I would say, just from my knowledge of speaking with the sales reps, that there are definitely a few interested parties. And with that, as soon as there's an A5 service or as soon as there's an A5 sale in Australia, the very next thing is going to be A5 flight training, which is going to be finding an Icon authorized flight instructor. So an independent instructor that can fly with owners within 100 nautical miles of their area, and then service provider. So, you know, owner, and then the very next step is getting that owner training and service over there. So within the year, I'd feel confident saying that.
Yeah, exciting. I know that I've actually met a couple of people who have had their name listed for an Icon. I don't think they've followed through with the purchase, but so there's definitely some interest over here for the Icon. Unfortunately, we don't have the beautiful lakes like you guys do. We've got a few, but not like around the Tampa area where there's just lakes everywhere. So it can be a bit challenging when you've just got open ocean, but there's some spots around Australia that would make Icon flying pretty unique and nice, I think.
Yeah, and that's another like huge unique part about the A5 is, like, in Tampa, 90% of the flying that I'm doing, or in Florida in general, is all saltwater. I'm landing in Tampa Bay. I'm landing in the intercoastal of Miami. So, I mean, we are 99.99% carbon fiber based aircraft. So going in salt water is a little less of a challenge for us. Obviously, if it's open water and you're dealing with huge wakes and rollers and stuff, that's a different aspect of your skill level to be able to do it. But a lot of our owners do operate in salt water on a regular basis, and it's definitely not an issue. So
there's not a lot of operators actually in Australia that operate freshwater, I don't think so. Because
no,
of
really?
That, yeah, because
you
of
don't
that
have
fact.
The option.
No, exactly. I mean, we operate the mallards into all salt water all the time. In fact, when we did a safari flight down to this seaplane festival in just north of Sydney last year, we deliberately landed in a freshwater lake just to experience it and get a bit of fresh water running through the bilges and everything.
Yeah.
I saw the other day that Icon have made now their 100th A5. Mm. How's the production going? How many do you make every week or month? Or tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, we hit the 100th landmark. I think it was towards the middle, at the end of last year or close to it, maybe middle end of last year. So we're at, well, I think our serial number at our production facility right now is 125. So we have 125 serial numbers out there. Last year we had a little bit more of a ramp up. We were producing about 4 to 6 a month. And we decided to downscale that. Obviously we did a pretty large layoff, like I said earlier. But our goal for this year was 48. So we wanted to, produce and manufacture 48 A5s this year. And of course, if the demands, we have the capacity to do a lot more, but we don't want to have a bunch of airframes sitting on the line. So we were just kind of scaling as the demand comes in, but 48 was our goal. Now, obviously with COVID and everything going on, our production facility has been down for, close to 2 months. So it might be a little bit less, or we might hit overdrive if, our sales keep going, which they are. So we'll see. I think, we'll be close to probably this time next year hitting that 200 mark if everything opens back up soon.
Yeah, cool. And talk about sales, like there's people obviously on a list for these aircraft. Like how many do you have backed up at the moment for a purchase?
So, and I think that's one of the, the big misconceptions. Obviously, like we had in the beginning before we were producing aircraft, we had, 2,000 deposit holders or something crazy like that. And we still have a lot of deposit holders, but, realizing we got a lot of those deposit holders when our price was listed at 189, or I think that was the original price before we actually started producing the aircraft. So obviously our current pricing structure is $359 for a fully loaded model of the A5. So, obviously we did lose some deposit holders in that process, but a lot of our deposit holders are still international. So us being a light sport category aircraft has been obviously a challenge to export to these other countries that have deposits. And we're working on trying to make that happen and make it an easier process. So right now we say that if you want an aircraft, it's about a 3-month lead time as far as, priorities. And a lot of, based on economics or family issues or whatever, a lot of people that are still interested in A5 that are within inside the United States have just deferred. So they're just not ready to take delivery of their aircraft. But so the taking care of our deposit holders on our list and then still taking care of new sales coming in, typically about a 3-month lead time.
Okay, 3 months is not too bad. I mean, my birthday's in December, so you never know.
Yeah, see,
I guess.
you could have an A5 in Australia by your birthday.
Happy days. That's put it on the list. I might just have to sell the house first. That's all. very cool. Now, last thing on the A5s, you take up some fairly prestigious passengers, I imagine. That if they're getting a demo at a Lamborghini car show, then they're obviously they're doing pretty well.
Yeah, definitely.
But one of those passengers you had is a pretty famous guy, Mr. Jay Leno.
Oh yes, yeah.
That was a pretty cool experience.
That was very cool. Yeah, he was so down to earth and just a really cool guy to meet. And his whole team was like excellent. I flew out to California, and I think that was his first time ever being in like a small airplane. And I think there was some debate between him and his wife on if he was going to be allowed to do it. he ended up obviously going forward with it, and he was really excited about it. We met at a boat ramp in Long Beach, California, and, kind of showed him how to take the airplane off the trailer. We got in, we took off from a marina, Long Beach, And we flew up the coast, and we ended up going to Burbank, where his showroom is, where all his cars are, which is like insane, like rooms upon rooms upon rooms of cars, which is was really amazing to see. But yeah, he was really cool. I think he was a little bit nervous, but I think anybody that's never been in a small airplane before, or even who have been in a small airplane but never done seaplane flying before, they have really no like grasp of like what's about to happen. But he was a trooper and he seemed to enjoy himself.
Yeah, and that was part of a series or something about cars that he does.
Yeah, he was. So he has a show called Jay Leno's Garage, and that episode was about, I guess, the progression of aviation and how it's kind of somewhat merging with the car industry and how, you know, flying cars might be the future. So he kind of just went through the history of aviation and where he thinks it's going. And he that same episode, he went and flew with like John Travolta, and he did some Air Force stuff, and he did a couple different things with a couple pilots. So it was pretty cool to be in that episode.
Yeah, exactly. John Travolta in the episode as well. That's pretty epic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Awesome. Thanks for telling us all about Icon there. Now you're based in Miami, and I'm a Mallard pilot. Is that the same base that the Mallards operate out of Chalks, where you operate now, or is that on the other side of the coast?
Yeah, so I'm actually based in Tampa, but we're in Miami a lot for demos and stuff. So yeah, the Miami Seaplane Base is the old historic Chalks seaplane right in the downtown Miami. You're taking off right next to cruise ships. It's a pretty cool experience.
Is there much history down there about Chalks and where they operated?
I think, you know, for the most part that everyone knows Chalk Airlines. And I think anytime that we tell them we're going to Miami Seaplane Base, that's the first thing they say. They're like, oh, that's where Chalks used to be. I was like, yeah, that's where we'll be at. It's right next to the cruise ships.
Yeah.
So I think everybody generally knows, you know, it was a huge seaplane operator in Florida, what Chalks was and where they operated.
Yeah. And is that where the other seaplane operator operates out of now, Flytropic?
Yeah. We see them all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tropic Ocean Airways. Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah. I saw a YouTube video the other day of you and taking another female pilot up. I'm not sure who she was, but
Sonia.
She seems popular. Lots of views. She's cool. Yeah. You guys ramped at the base there, and I saw a few of the Flytropic seaplanes there. So I thought that was where your base was, but that was just a little flying visit, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's the primary like demo location when we are down there. And we used to have a full-time sales rep now. Or down there. Now the sales rep for that region is full-time in Tampa, but I'd say at least once a month we're down in that area.
Yeah. Do you have a ramp where you are at Tampa?
There is a ramp in, so our flight center, which is pretty unique, is on this island called Davis Island. And on one side is the airport field at our flight center. And I look to my other side and it's the marina. So if we're teaching ramping that day, because it's not connected to the airport, we'll take off from the airport, we'll land right outside the marina, we'll taxi in the marina and then ramp up and down a couple times to teach it, and then we'll leave the marina and take off and then go about our way.
Oh, epic. I'm just looking at it now. That's very unique little airport right on the ocean there. That's really cool.
Yeah.
So is there other operators out of that airport as well, are they?
No, they were the only seaplane operator out of this airport. There's one or two people that own there. I think there's a Lake Amphibian on the field, and I think there's a Sea Ray on the field, but no other operator. So honestly, I take off from the airport and I rarely ever climb above 500 feet because our practice area that we typically instruct at is literally like 2-3 nautical miles southeast of us. So we take off, stay under 500 feet, go to our practice area. I think we're in line with, there's a lot of helicopter operators around here, some EMS guys, and some tours. So if anything, we probably have to look out for them more than we do other airplanes.
Yeah, right. So jealous. Seaplane flying in the States sounds epic.
Mm-hmm. It's definitely a lot of fun. Although I've been following you on social media for a long time, and your videos and photos that you post seem pretty amazing too.
Yeah, we do have a very unique operation here in Darwin on the Mallard, which is great fun. It's challenging in its own rights, but yeah, definitely. I think throwing around these little light sports into all these little bays and lakes. Yeah. That's the ultimate seaplane flying, I think.
Yeah, definitely. You get into some small confined areas if you wanted to.
Yeah. Well, Janessa, it's been awesome having you on the show and listening to your story, especially all about the Icon A5. It's certainly opened my eyes up a little bit about the aircraft and about how it's all run over there in the States, and hopefully a few listeners have answered a few of their questions as well. But before we get going, I've got a little segment called the Splash and Dash questionnaire.
Oh, okay.
Just like the land plane touch and go, the seaplane splash and dash, we're just going to touch on a few subjects here.
Okay.
Now, you're probably going to answer this one straight away with since we've interviewed and talked all about it, but is the Icon A5 your favorite seaplane that you've ever flown?
Yeah, definitely. But I haven't really flown that many other seaplanes before. So although it is my favorite that I have, I probably should, broaden my horizons and see what else is out there, because you never know.
That's true. That's true. Have you flown on any other seaplanes that you've really loved?
I guess the Cub on floats, that's what I learned on. I've flown the 185 and I've flown 172 on float. So the Cub, out of those three, float-wise, definitely my favorite.
What about as a passenger?
As a passenger? No, I don't think I've ever been a passenger in a seaplane.
Yeah, right. Not even the Flytropic Caravan or anything over to the Bahamas for a day trip? Or?
No, I guess I need to. I need to dive deeper into that avenue.
Yeah, absolutely. Get over there.
Check it out.
What would be your dream seaplane to fly? If you could pick any seaplane in the world, what would be your dream seaplane?
Dream seaplane. Honestly, the Grumman, I think would be a lot of fun to fly. I guess there's not a lot of twin seaplanes out there. So I think getting my multi-engine sea and exploring that avenue would be pretty cool. So I'd jump on that boat.
Pardon the pun. We don't have this whole multi-engine sea, single-engine sea thing like you guys do over there. So that's quite different. But definitely twin-engine seaplanes. That was always my goal for a long time, and I thought it was always going to be in the Maldives on the Twin Otter there. Mm-hmm. But turns out it was the Mallard, which is still I think it's even cooler. But what about you're probably in it right now? But what would be your dream seaplane job? Anything around the world that really sparks your interest? Being like that would be the coolest job in the world.
Mm-hmm. I had, and I don't know if they ever kicked off, but I know for a long time that they were trying to get an operation in Greece, hopping around all the islands.
Yes,
in Greece,
I did see
the
that.
Seaplanes.
Yeah,
and that would be probably my dream job. That would be awesome.
Yeah, I think it was a Twin Otter they were trying to start up from memory, and island hopping around the Greek islands. Geez, that'd be pretty good.
Yeah.
We can dream. We can dream. What about private seaplane? If you were just like some rich guy who had a Lamborghini, or rich girl who had a Lamborghini, I should say, and you could afford any seaplane in the world to fly around and just have a private seaplane, would it be the Icon, or would you go for something bigger, or what would you choose?
No, I think I would stick with the Icon. If I had a lot of money and all the resources in the world, I'd convince Icon maybe to stick a little bit beefier engine in, maybe a little bit more payload, and I'd stay with the A5.
Lakes, rivers, or open ocean, what would you prefer to land a seaplane on, or operate a seaplane in?
I love salt water. I think going intercoastal flying and going island hopping is a lot of fun. So I'd say definitely salt water. The second best would be mountain lake flying, because I've done some, not a lot of mountain flying, but a couple that I have done were also really just, it's gorgeous.
Yeah, that is pretty cool. I got a chance to fly a Cub in New Zealand last year, and up into a lake at 4,000 feet or something. We nearly couldn't get out because it was so high.
I believe it.
Yeah, but that was pretty epic. Something very unique that I've never done before. But that's the cool thing about the Icon and all these new composite seaplanes that are coming out, especially in the light sport categories, is salt water just now becomes pretty irrelevant, doesn't it? Nothing that these metal aircraft, they all have all these problems with corrosion, whereas the Icon and those composites don't have that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, when I talk to some seaplane pilots that have Cubs or 172s, they're like, oh, no, I'm not going in salt water. I'm like, what? That takes away half of your adventures you could be doing right now.
Exactly. And finally, would you give any advice for aspiring pilots out there, especially aspiring seaplane pilots? What would you say to them about getting into float planes And have you got any specific advice to those people?
Good question. I would say if you, and kind of just what happened to me, even if you're like remotely interested in seaplane flying, but you're not sure like how to get in with somebody, like just go get it. Like your seaplane, at least in the United States, like it's so cheap relatively compared to a lot of other ratings that you're going to get, relatively inexpensive to get your seaplane rating. So even if you have it and you don't do anything with it for, you know, 6 months or a year, like I did, eventually something might just stumble in your lap where, you know, the opportunity is there. So I always tell people like create the opportunity that you want. So if you want to become a seaplane pilot, go get your seaplane rating, even if you don't know where you're going with it yet. And then aviation industry is pretty small. So I think the more people you meet with inside the industry and the more people you connect with and you build that relationship with, if you want to be a seaplane pilot and you want to do stuff, if it's, you know, in Alaska or, you know, the Bahamas or Australia, like you're going to meet those people that you want by going to get your rating and finding those other pilots that want to be seaplane pilots and making connections. So be friendly. Go to airports, make more friends, go get your seaplane rating and just connect and talk with people.
Yeah, that's such good advice. It's basically the exact advice that I give everyone else as well. It's just, you know, get that rating done, be a pest, go and see people, find some friends in the seaplane industry. I mean, these days with social media, it's so easy to connect with other seaplane pilots and just start chatting with them. It's becoming easier to get in contact. So, yeah, really good advice. And, yeah, Janessa, you said that we'd be struggling to get up an hour of good content with you. You didn't think you were that interesting, but we have made it to the hour mark. So congratulations.
Good.
No, it's been really good fun talking to you. I'm sure all the listeners are going to love hearing this and listening to your story. And I'd like to say thank you very much for coming on the show. And yeah, all the best.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And that's the show for today, folks. If that doesn't make you put your name down for an Icon purchase, I don't know what will. Thanks, Janessa, for an epic episode. Now, make sure you check her out on Instagram, like I mentioned before, at IGotYour6, the number 6. And don't forget to leave me a review if you like this podcast. 5 stars, thank you very much. Now, before we go, this next episode taster is a beauty.
And I got on the step and I'm belting along the side of the ship and everything's going really well. And I thought, I'm getting near the end. Oh, hang on. What am I going to do? I said, I don't think I've got enough airspeed to lift off. And all these big swells are in front of me. I thought, oh, well, hang on. What I'll do is I'll just lift it off and then purposely put it down on the top of the first swell. And hopefully I have enough speed to get away. Well, I had to actually hit 2 swells before I got away, but I got away, fortunately. And I guess the only reason I was being so gung-ho, I was a bit like the fighter pilots during the Second World War, you know. They didn't really go out without having had a few drinks first.
If you don't recognise that voice, it is Kevin Bowe, the founder of basically Australia's most iconic seaplane company, Air With Sunday, which Kevin started back in 1973. Kevin has so many amazing old school seaplane stories. I've had to make this a 2-part episode. So part one will be coming out a day earlier this week on Tuesday, with part two following a day later on Wednesday. It's a bloody ripper chat, folks, and I can't wait to get it into your ears. But unfortunately, it's that time of the podcast again. Until next time, everyone, thanks for coming on The Step.